Noor. What with all the unanswerable questions and the travelling between uncomfortable past and uncertain future back and forth, Noor gets about 2 hours of sleep. She moves through the morning in a fog, looking at herself in the mirror closely as she brushes her teeth, trying to work out if she's still dreaming. She's not sure. The familiarity of the toothbrush, with its splayed bristles, and the one defunct spotlight around the bathroom mirror, the apple on the car seat at the traffic lights, the gates of the clinic, all these say, not a dream. But then, arriving at work to be met by Jim Stokes and a security guard, with Marie in the background trying not to stare, and being told that she's been temporarily suspended from her post while investigations are carried out into whether or not serious misconduct took place on her part, all that feels distinctly dreamlike. When Noor looks at Jim, she half expects him to turn into her father, or for all her teeth to drop out. Noor stands for a second, waiting. Nobody changes into anybody. Her teeth are still in her jaw, trying not to chatter. "Okay, then," she says. "What happens now?"
"You can take what you need from your office," Jim says. "Personal effects, obviously. No company property. Mark here will go with you, while..."
"While you scuttle back to your office," Noor mentally fills in. But that's not fair. Noor's quite fond of scuttling into an office herself. She and Jim are both this way. Industrious, tunnelling creatures. As opposed to Louise, who is not. But then, Noor's still not quite sure what sort of creature Louise is. She goes to her office with Mark. They don't make conversation, though she considers asking him where he's going on his holidays. "I hear the Maldives are lovely this time of year, Mark." She opens her desk drawer and takes out her tea and sugar. She puts them into her bag, takes the drawer key and her office key off the fob and puts them down on the desk. "There you go," she says.
"That's it?" says Mark.
He looks surprised. Noor considers the room, in case there's something she missed.
It looks like her room. It also looks a lot like nobody was ever there.
"What now?"
But she doesn't really have much say in that, does she? Go home. That's all she can do now. Go home, live her life. Hope that whatever happens next is for the best.
What happened to Orlando Palladino? Love made him insane, so they took it out of his brain. History does not record what happened after that. Noor's sitting in a coffee shop near the river. The window has a partial view of the water. A swan crosses it slowly. Who else? Clementine and Joel? Whether or not their second attempt at love was doomed to fail, their efforts to forget each other were misguided. When Joel is first seen, waiting at the train station, his head emerging from the shuffling rows of commuters, both questing and hopeless, it's obvious that he's miserable. When he lies upturned in his bed, he looks like a dead man floating in the sea. The facts of the love are gone. The biographical notes redacted, but the love is still there. There is no eternal sunshine. There is no spotless mind. There are three types of memory. Noor learned that when she did her second degree in psychology. At the time, she considered it just a different type of software programming, thinking herself superior software, of course. The first type of memory is episodic, a memory of something happening. For example, a memory of playing the piano at a concert.
The second type is conceptual, the knowledge that you can play the piano. Amnesiacs actually retain their conceptual knowledge. They might know they are a pianist, even if they can't remember a single performance. The final type is procedural memory, remembering how to play the piano. Like conceptual knowledge, it can survive the destruction of other memories, which is how amnesiacs can sit down at the piano and actually play. The problem with Star Trek is that it didn't show that Captain Kirk was different after the death of Raina, Noor thinks. He would have known that he was a man who had been in love, even if he'd never learned how to do it properly or couldn't remember one single person he'd loved. He would have lain upturned in his bed and thought, something is missing. Two women come into the coffee shop. The barista says hello to them as if she recognizes them. They order their drinks and sit down, talking about a new documentary series one has seen and says the other one has to see. Back at the clinic, W. Hall will be in the middle of his or her restoration. Staff from various departments will be talking in the kitchen, probably about Louise's departure, or Noor's disgrace, or maybe just about TV shows. At Noor's house, empty spaces, clean floors, a neatly made bed, a TV planner full of unwatched shows, none of which Noor has been told to see or told anyone else to see. On the other side of the river, there's a small park. A few people sitting on the benches, in the cold, waiting patiently for the sun to come out from behind the clouds. A woman pushing a pram, accompanied by a Dalmatian. The woman sees an older man, waves, stops, and the two of them talk as the Dalmatian circles the man's legs and tries to push its nose into his palm. Noor feels very far from the town, the people, the dogs. Even when she goes out into the town, she doesn't walk with people. She walks amongst them. What else walks amongst? Death? God? Murderers? Monsters? Nothing good. Outwalk, she thinks. She wonders, for a moment, what an inwalk would feel like. Out of the coffee shop's other window, Noor can see a man standing, facing the road, waiting to cross. He's holding his hand up to shield his eyes from the sun, which is pointing right at him. He waits for a long time. She thinks the sun must be strong, because the man obviously can't see that the road is completely empty. It's a main road, and cars do travel down it quite quickly, but there hasn't been a car in a while, and here he still stands, squinting up and down. And when something does come down the road, a lorry, he lowers his hand and lifts his foot, and looks almost as if he's decided that now is the time to cross. And then the man steps out. Everything is so nonsensical then that Noor registers it as elements only, floating pieces. A howling mechanical noise. Sun. Her tea, overturned, spreading across the table. A man in the road. A human noise. A crying out. Noor runs out of the cafe, past the lorry, which has swerved a little further down the road, mounted the curb and come to a stop. She reaches the man, who is kneeling, strangely, next to the pavement. As she crouches down beside him, he topples sideways and she catches his weight, which sends her half sprawling on the ground, holding his body. An abrupt, wet warmth spreads across her own stomach and legs. She's saying something, but she has no idea what it is. One side of the man's head is dark and tangled with blood. His face is turned up to her own. His eyes are still open. They're green. She's never seen green eyes before, or not up close. They don't have much consciousness in them. They waver over the roof lines, the sky. The lids drop and open, like mouths trying for words. For 1 second, they catch on Noor's, and there it is. His self. Annetta, he says. Then the self passes out of his eyes. The lids come down. Noor holds her fingers against the warm skin of his neck. She doesn't even know what she's doing. She's never checked a pulse before. There must be a pulse there. She's just too ignorant to find it. Other people are gathering now, around the two of them. The lorry driver is here, an unsteady man who moves towards them, then away, and throws up over a wall. He thinks it's worse than it is, Noor thinks. It's fine. It's just a lot of blood, making everything look dramatic. Look, his face is so calm. There's not much blood on his head, not really. He's just passed out. She wants to tell the lorry driver not to worry, but he won't hear her over the noise of people shouting and talking around her. Passers-by, a security guard and a sales assistant from a nearby shop, both uniformed, the waitress from the coffee shop. No police or paramedics, but they're on the way, that's what the people around her keep saying. And then sirens can be heard, and everyone says, "See? That's them, they're coming." "He's dead," someone says. They're crying. "It's too late." Noor ignores that. It's the blood, she thinks, and the strange way the man's body looks, maybe. People have glanced at him and made the casual assumption that he is dead. They aren't looking at his face. It's a pleasant, uneventful face. He looks like he's dozed off, in fact. Like it's that lull time of a Sunday and he's been on the sofa watching TV and the afternoon sun slipped in and drowsed him into a peaceful nap. His hair is grey-brown, with a slight bald patch on the top of his head. Lying next to him is a plain brown shoe with a scuff on one toe. On his wrist is an inexpensive digital watch, its broken face reflecting the sunlight. She notices one of his eyebrows is disturbed, but she can't smooth it back, not with blood on her fingers. How could someone so normal be dead? How can someone die in a small town on a sunny afternoon? It's too dramatic. It's not plausible. A police car and an ambulance appear and pull over. People run towards Noor and the man she holds. A paramedic crouches down and takes hold of the man's wrist. He listens to his heart. He opens one of the man's green eyes and shines a torch into it. He looks up at another paramedic and he shakes his head. "Do you know him?" a female police officer is saying to Noor, crouching down beside her. She has one of those warm, gentle voices that usually annoy Noor, but doesn't just now. Noor nods, feeling like it's true. She knows this man better than they do, anyway. She notices that the crowd has grown. People are standing all around her, people with shopping bags. Some of the protesters from the clinic, the security guard, the waitress, texting now, tearfully. There's a Nepenthe technician here too. A woman she knows is called Kath, holding a half-eaten baguette, talking to another police officer. "He just left the clinic," Kath says. "He said he was going to call his wife. I saw him in the grounds when I was leaving. I was on my lunch break. You need to call the clinic. Get someone down here." "No, I don't know his name." "W. Hall," thinks Noor. "But that's Dr. Ali," she can hear Kath saying. "Noor Ali." "I don't know." "No, she's a doctor at the clinic." Dr. Ali? The police officer with Noor asks. Noor nods. The paramedics are going to take over now, says the officer. We need you to come and sit down. Paramedics surround Noor and gently lift W. Hall up, off her. The police officer holds out her hand. Noor takes it. She gets up. She allows someone to put a blanket on her, noticing as they do that her blanket is different to the one they are putting on W. Hall after they lift him onto the stretcher. One blanket for the living, one for the dead. William Hall, a paramedic says, holding a wallet open. Before the ambulance leaves, she asks if she can sit inside it for a moment. The police officers and paramedics look at each other, as if they're hoping one of them, someone else, will say no, but nobody says it, and so they agree. Noor can get in. So she climbs inside and stands next to William Hall's covered body. Me again, she says. She'd take his hand, but it's been wrapped up with the rest of him. She touches the corner of his dead people blanket instead. The blood has dried on her own hands, cracked, splintered into dark flakes. Goodbye, William, she says. Seeing as nobody else has said it,